text of Hebrews chapter 11 and chapter 12. As we talk a bit about the race that is set before us, using the illustration that the Hebrew writer uses in this 11th chapter to bolster our faith. And so I want to share with you a couple of thoughts about this in the beginning. The roll call of faith, as we call it, or at least I call it many times from this pulpit, the roll call of faith that is mentioned, Hebrews chapter 11 consists of Old Testament characters that serve as an example to us, and they are actually chronologically directed in, by the Hebrew writer's narration, beginning with Abel in verse 4. If you'll note, beginning in verse 1, let's start off in verse 1 just to make note of this, where he gives a definition of faith. Faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. We recognize that as we live our lives here on this earth, there are things that we take by faith. It's interesting that there are individuals who are not willing to believe what they can't see when it comes to spiritual things, and yet they do that all the time in their day-to-day living as they witness the effects of physical things, for example, or as they trust in historians of our own nation. And there are many examples that we can give of this. There is even in science a doctrine called the doctrine of uniformitarianism, which means that the belief that is the basis upon which geology especially is based, but the age of the earth and those things, is that what happened in the past is basically the same structure, the same things, the powers, everything that goes on today is going on as it has in past times. Now, that's not saying that maybe 10 million years ago a comet hit or something like that, but just the point that there's nothing new, nothing different from before that isn't here today. And they can't prove that because they haven't seen it. They weren't there at that time, but there is that doctrine that basically governs this aspect of science that is one of the reasons why there are so long dates. That's not even making sense. The dates that are so old as given to the age of the earth and the age of the universe, in the idea that the idea of a supernatural intervention that brought everything into being in a single day just doesn't make sense to them, because it doesn't fly it flies in the face of what they have been raised to believe with this doctrine of uniformitarianism. So there are people who are unwilling, at least to admit the fact that they live their lives taking by faith things that they have not themselves witnessed. But we as Christians embrace that. It doesn't say that we don't live our lives without evidence, but it is to say that based upon what we have seen of God in the past, in the annals of history, through what is revealed, for example, in God's Word, we have confidence that what God has promised will happen, will indeed happen, if we act in accord with His will. And we admit that these things are by faith, because faith is that substance for the things that we hope. And it is the evidence, as we contemplate, for example, the faith that we have in the miracles of Jesus and the crucifixion of our Lord and the many other examples that we find in both the Old and the New Testaments. We take that and we extrapolate from that the validity of the promises that God has given to us. And we do not in any way apologize for it, because it is valid. It's not based in mere imagination or superstition. It is based in fact. But in fact, we ourselves were not there 2,000 years ago when Jesus died on the cross of Calvary. And so we have faith that He did, and we have faith in the promises that come as a direct result of that sacrifice and the realization of the scheme of redemption that is given by God. So I think that's an important thing for us to indicate. But as He talks about faith, He gives examples. And that's what the purpose of the chapter is. As we start with verse 4 and look at, for example, in verses 4 through 7, men like Abel and Enoch and Noah. These all are individuals that we talk to our children about in the Bible classes because there are good lessons that can be learned from each of those primary lessons that actually are lessons that the Hebrew writer talks about with regard to these men that were at the dawn of time. Abel being the son of Adam, and he offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than his brother Cain. And because of that, he obtained witness that he was righteous, and God testified of his gifts. So this is our first example that we give. And as we go and look at the narration, the historical narration of Abel, as we look in the book of Genesis, we recognize that he is a wonderful example to us of an individual who had faith. Now, as we go through these, and we look at them very rapidly, because we're not going to go over all of them with any detail, I just want you to understand the lesson that he is teaching, and that basically is this, that as we see how God treated those who went before us, who were faithful to him, that gives us the motivation and the purpose to live lives that are like theirs, lives that are lived by faith, responses of faith because of what God has promised us. And we'll get to that conclusion when we get into the verse chapter 12 of the text. But the second one in verse 5 is Enoch. We are told that Enoch did not see death. He was taken by God because he had this testimony that he pleased God. And then finally, in verse 7, we have Noah. And everyone, again, is familiar with the story of Noah. By faith, built an ark, and he saved humanity as well as the peoples, as well as the animals from the flood that had been sent by God as judgment upon humanity. And because of that, we're told in verse 7 of the text, he became heir of the righteousness, which is according to faith. Now, you'll notice that these all predated Abraham. And so these are from the earliest years of man's existence where these examples are given. There's an important point to be made because as we look at the book of Hebrews, sometimes we may have this idea that we're being given examples from the covenant of Moses. And that's not only the case. We are, when we get to Moses, aren't we? But the patriarchs that preceded Moses, as well as these individuals from antiquity, these individuals are wonderful examples to us of what faith is and how God gives us assurance that our faith will be rewarded. This has always been the case, is what I'm saying, with regard to how God has treated man. He's not always required the same things of man, but he has always required love and diligence and service to him. We must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek after him. And those who did so, even in antiquity, even at the dawn of time, they received the blessings of God as a result of that. And then that gets us down to Abraham himself. And in fact, it's interesting that in this particular text that there are several mentions of Abraham because he is a very significant person in the history of God's dealing with men. He is the one to whom God gave the covenant that he would make of him a great nation, that he would give that nation a land, which was the land of promise, the land of Canaan, and that thirdly, it would be through his seed or descendants, or descendant, because he said seed as of one, not many. So he was referring to the Christ, that the whole earth, all of the earth, you and I included, would be blessed. And so Abraham is given a special amount of time in these texts. We're told in chapter or verse 8 of chapter 11 that by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called out to go to the place. There is what we have in the latter part, or excuse me, in the beginning, in chapters 11 and 12 of Genesis with regard to Abraham's initial entrance onto the scene, and that he was told by God to go to a strange land and to pilgrim in his life in a strange land. And because he believed in God, that's exactly what he did. We're told in verse 9, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise, because he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is is God. When you look at this, I think it's a wonderful expression of the fact that Abraham didn't have it like the rest of Israel did as they entered into the land and took it as a possession as God had promised. Abraham was given that initial promise and gone and told to go into that land and dwell there as a pilgrim. This is not going to be your land. It will be the land of your descendants. I'm showing you this land. You're to live your life in this land away from your relatives. I am God. Do what I tell you to do. And he willingly did that and dwelt in tents. Now, I ask you, recognizing where we are today is different from where they were at that time, but would you like to sojourn your entire life? Now, it's all right to go on vacation. And now some people will, what they call, glamp instead of camp, because they'll take an RV and they'll travel from place to place and they'll hook up at the RV parks and have a mini home, which is probably a better home than most humans have ever had as they existed upon this earth. But Abraham dwelt in tents as a nomad, traveled from one place to another with his wife and with his nephew and with his servants. And so he waited. He knew that he wasn't going to see it, but he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He knew he wasn't going to see what God was going to fulfill through him, but what he was looking for is the eternal reward, waiting for that, waiting for God to do what God said God was going to do. And we can learn a great deal from that. Sarah is another example in verse 11 of the text. And then I want you to note that there is a break that is taken, and it's worthy of our reading, in verses 13 through 16. So we're talking about those who were in antiquity. Up until the time of Abraham and Sarah, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. They were assured of them, embraced them, confessed they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly they seek a homeland. This is the attitude that we are to have. This is what in our Christian profession, as we determine that we're going to be separate from the world, we're not going to conduct ourselves the way the world conducts ourselves. Now, I don't want to know what it is that you give of your means on the first day of the week and what percentage it is and those things. But I'll tell you this, the world looks with a bit of puzzlement at the fact that we would give such a large portion of those things to a God. And so many are struggling economically in this world to give a significant portion of what you have received back to the one who gave it to you, when the one who gave it to you, he's not here in the sense of you can see his face. He's not knocking on your door like one who you owed rent to would be knocking on your door. He's not someone who compels you like the government to give these types of things. It's a free will offering, but we freely give that because we have confessed, we understand it's not about this earth. It's not about this world. It's not about our time here. The world really doesn't understand that. One of the most obvious ways that was brought home to me had to do with the time that I was raising my children in school, and it especially was with regard to the boys because they didn't have any problems, and their teammates and such in sports have any problems with ragging on them a little bit and making fun of them, but they did do that. It was maybe in fun rather than hateful, but at the very least, they just didn't understand why both Josh and Jeremiah spent so much time concerned about the things of God. It wasn't on their radar at all. It isn't on the radar of most young people, but a Christian young person who devotes his life in service to God, who spends time in worship, who really is concerned about what comes after this life when we've just started this life and there is so much to explore, there's so much to do, there is so much to try. And to put limitations upon yourself at the very beginning, that's just not something people are interested in doing. And that's why we got drug problems. That's why we got sexual promiscuity. That's why all of those kinds of things happen, because people want to try something new and see if it fits them, see if they'll enjoy that. And they chafe at limitations. But as Christians, we've decided that because our life is a pilgrimage, that we're going to act as strangers on this earth, and the things that the world embarks upon and imbibes in, we're just not going to do those things because God said not to. And it's more important for us to realize our hope of heaven than anything that this life has to offer. Well, it's not new to the Christian faith to do that. That has been the case with regard to individuals who have lived throughout the history of mankind who had an awareness of God and His steadfastness and faithfulness toward them. And that was true with these individuals. If they had called to mind the country from which they had come out, maybe they would have opportunity to return. In other words, I could go back at any time. Demas forsook Paul because he loved the present world and he just went back. He spent some time being a pilgrim, being a stranger to the world, trying to live for God, but boy, the pull of the world was so much that he decided that he was going to go back. But these individuals did not, because they desire a better, a heavenly country. And because of that, God is not ashamed to be called their God, because He has prepared that city. So just wonderful, wonderful examples to us all the way back from antiquity. But then we get into a discussion of the days which led to the establishment of the nation of Israel, God's chosen people. It's kind of interesting that Dennis, you'll remember as he was giving us those signs, one of the signs were the patriarchs. And there are three patriarchs, but he always put Joseph in the end. Well, the Hebrew writer agreed with him, because here we have in the list and the faith of the patriarchs in verses 17 through 22, those same four men mentioned. So Abraham is mentioned again, and this time it does not have to do with where he went in the promises God gave him, but the command that God gave him to sacrifice the son of promise. And can you imagine such a thing? God, okay, I'm willing to live my life dwelling in tents. I trust that these things are going to happen. And you said that you're going to give me a son. And look, you gave me a son. And then God says, go kill your son. Go offer your son as a sacrifice. And by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. You'll notice it says he was tested. That was God testing him. And we're told that Abraham concluded, now we don't know this except through divine inspiration, in verse 19, he concluded that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead. Do you understand what Abraham believed here? God promised me that this great nation would come from this man, this son. He promised me that all the earth would be blessed through this son. And now he's telling me to kill this son. He's not being unfaithful to me. He is telling me that this son is going to die, but this son is going to come back from the dead, or else these things couldn't happen. That's how great his faith was. So he was willing, and that's why he was willing to do that. He wasn't saying, God, I can't believe that you told me to do this, and then you're not doing it. No. He knew that God was going to do what God said he was going to do, because God is faithful with regard to his promises. And this was, in his mind, how it would happen. It's not how it happened, because God had different plans and stayed his hand at the last moment when Abraham passed the test. But he willingly offered up his son. Isaac was dead to him at that time because he had raised his hand to kill his son until it was stopped by the Lord. And so we've got Abraham, a man of great faith. And we have his son, Isaac, who blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. And verse 21, by faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped leaning on the top of his staff, his name being changed to Israel. And then finally, in verse 22, by faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instruction concerning his bones. All of these men lived and died in faith, not having received the promises that we have today because we live on this side of the cross. But they were men of faith, and because God told them it was going to happen, they were willing to put up with all of the problems and trials in their lives, live their lives in maybe what many would say are ascetic ways, giving up things, not having things that other people enjoy, and doing that just because there was a being who had promised them eternity. And they accepted it by faith. Faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And that gets us down to Moses. We're told in verse 23, by faith Moses, Well, actually, this one is about his parents, because his parents had faith. He was, we are told, because he was a beautiful child and they weren't afraid of the king's command, he was protected from death. And then we're told in verse 24 that Moses himself, when he became of age, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And this is an important verse, verse 25 of the text. Choosing instead to suffer affliction with the people of God than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Esteeming the reproach of Christ. Now wait a minute. Christ hadn't suffered reproach yet, had he? Christ hadn't suffered the indignity of the cross at this point in time. But that's the choice that Moses made because that's what he was told was going to happen. And by faith he believed what God had to say about what would happen in the future and the part that he would play in that. He forsook Egypt, he kept the Passover, and he led them through the Red Sea, as stated in verse 29. And all of these are stories that you know about. And then we get down to the time of the entrance into the land and the conquest of the land. And we're into the time of the judges. Now, we won't pass over Rahab, which happened at the beginning of their conquest of the land of Canaan. But then in verse 32, he starts going quickly here. And I'm going to have to go quickly as well because we're already coming close to the end of our time together. But he mentions Gideon. Gideon, who was the judge that delivered them from the Midianites, is related in Judges chapter 6. Speaks of Barak, who led the people of Israel against Sisera, as recorded in Judges chapter 4. Samson, who again was the judge lifted up to take them out of the oppression of the Philistines. And Samson's story is mentioned in Judges 13. And then you have also Jephthah, another judge, in Judges chapter 11 that was able to secure their victory and their liberty from Ammon, who had oppressed them. And so these men are judges, but he also put David and Samuel and the prophets in here. Now he's going very quickly, isn't he? So we could take the time and go throughout the entire history of Israel, but this is the one point that he is making, is these individuals did the same thing as those individuals we've already talked about, where he gave individual by individual an example of their faith. These men lived by faith as well. David, a friend of God. Abraham, a friend of God. These men had the heart of God. They desired what God wanted for them, and they were willing to sacrifice in order to obtain these things. And so I want to just read you this short series of verses beginning in verse 33 of the text. Because there is a positive and a negative to this I want to make note of. He said, all these individuals that have been mentioned subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others, okay, he's been talking about mighty valorous things that they accomplished. But then others were tortured. Well, they didn't have the same victories that some that we have mentioned before have received, but that didn't change the fact that they were willing to do what they could to please God and willing to wait for the promises that would come. Look at these horrible things. They were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. They had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. It's not easy to be a child of God, one who seeks after God. Sometimes God in His providence supplies you these victories. Why did He do that? Why did He do it? Well, one, because they were His chosen people, but number two, because it furthered His will, His desires, that man be redeemed in the way in which that was going to be accomplished. And it was also a part of His will to allow these negative things. And so I would just hasten to say that if in your faith you become somewhat discouraged because of how you are suffering as a demonstration of that faith, recognize that God has never promised the life is going to be easy. All he has promised is if you are steadfast, the next life will be wonderful. The next life in every way will surpass this one, whether it be with regard to duration, because it is eternity, or whether it be regarding joy, the peace which passes understanding, all the wonderful blessings that come in Jesus Christ. And so these individuals, we are told, the world was not worthy of them as they wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. What happened with every one of them? All of these examples we have in the Old Testament, they obtained a good testimony through faith. But they didn't receive the promise because God provided something better for us that they should not be made perfect apart from us. See what the Hebrew writer is saying here? Because the entirety of the text of Hebrews is saying, hey, what we have is what is better than what they have. The New Testament, better than the Old Testament. Christ, better than the bulls and goats. We have all of those examples that are given throughout Scripture. And what he's saying now is these guys were willing, and gals, were willing to do what they could to serve God and be accepted by God, despite the fact that what they received in their time on this earth does not compare to what we have obtained. The redemption in Christ was for them as well, but they didn't receive it in their lifetime. We embrace the truth that we receive it because Christ has already died for us and His kingdom has been established. And the instant we become obedient to the gospel of Christ, redemption is ours. Now, they're redeemed as well, but it's through the blood of Christ as well, and that hadn't happened yet. And so they wondered, they did these things, and they lived and died in faith, not having received the promises at the time of their death. And that's where we get into the 12th chapter. And this is where we get this truth. And we'll draw the lesson to a close after this. Notice verses 1 and 2. There is a reason why the Hebrew writer gave this list. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, these individuals just mentioned, we need to lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us and run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. That's why we have what we have, because of what Jesus has done for us. Why does Abraham have what Abraham has? Because of what Jesus did for him. David, because of what Jesus did for him. Moses, same thing. The prophets, because of what Jesus did. The only difference is, he hadn't done it yet. Boy, these people were great in their faith. They saw God. God made a promise. They believed it. Brethren, understand this. We have a step further. As we look at their lives and we look at how steadfast they are, there are Christians today who are aware of the death of Christ on Calvary. He died on that cross. And they know that that's the case, and yet they do not remain steadfast in their faith. We have the advantage. God said He was going to do it. They lived in faith. God did it. We sometimes can falter in our faith, despite the fact that it's already done. It is what they call, in whatever language it is, I think it's French, but it's off the top of my head, a fait accompli. Is that right? French? French? Audrey's an English major. She's not a French major. Okay. So a fait accompli. This is already happened. It is done. And we need to recognize that it has occurred, so it is also a fait accompli. It is done that if we remain steadfast, the promises of God will be fulfilled in us. And so our faith should be great as well. We don't have excuses that they had. Well, I haven't seen anything yet, or I haven't seen enough yet. We have seen it all. We've seen the greatest expression of God's love, the greatest example of God's giving us what He promised He would give us when He sent His Son Jesus. And so as a result of that, we need to look to Jesus. He's the one that authored our faith. He is the originator of it. He is the one that is the finisher. He's the one that when He was on the cross of Calvary, having lived that perfect life, and died that sacrificial death, the last words he proclaimed, "It is finished." He finished the faith. It's done. Everything that we need, we have. And all that remains is for us to live out our existence here on this earth and then join God in heaven if we're steadfast, if we have faith. And so I call upon you all to have that very thing. We don't know the minds of any who are here today and what your desire might be, but it may be that there is one who needs to respond to the invitation at this time. For any reason, if you desire that, would you come now?